This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
This week on the Mike Wise Show, Lakers owner Jeannie Buss unplugged. We'll talk about her losing the trifecta of all time, her mother, David Stern, and Kobe Bryant. We'll share stories of the Lakers' return to the top of the NBA once again. And basically, this is probably the most personal interview I've ever done on the podcast. So, Darlene, please do your thing.
The Mike Wise Show is a presentation of Pure Hoops Media. The Mike Wise Show is hosted by a guy who played basketball atrociously for Hawaii Pacific College, which forced him into journalism. And, oh yeah, he wrote about basketball for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and ESPN. He's also a wise ass, and so are many of his guests. Right, Mike?
Thank you, Darlene. And now that the Lakers have secured banner number 17, the purple and gold are back on top of the basketball world, and we are joined by the boss woman herself, Lakers owner, or should we say Lakers governor, Jeannie Buss. Welcome back, Jeannie.
Thank you for that distinction. I like governor because I'm not the only owner. There's co-owners, my siblings and other Lakers shareholders. And so thank you for governor, but I am the one governor, yes.
And you're the majority owner, right?
My family is, the family trust, yes.
I can say with factual certainty that you're the first female owner, governor of a franchise to win an NBA title. And I don't think that was made as much as it should have been after you guys won. I think that it's a barrier. It's a milestone.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I don't look at it that way, but I know when I was younger how much it meant to me to see women in powerful positions. That inspired me. So, I welcome that if I'm inspiring young women to say, well, if she can do that, then I can do whatever it is that I want to take on. And if I can be an inspiration for that, then I welcome it.
I look at it, I mean, I think it's great, but I also look at it, all the heat that you and, for instance, Linda Rambis, the executive director of Special Projects, a good friend of yours, wife of Kurt, but a very important person in the Lakers organization, first of all. And I almost felt like when things were going poorly, I wondered if some of the criticism bordered on misogynistic. And did you think so?
I absolutely agree with that. There are members of the media that cover our sport, our league, who follow all the other governors in the league, but don't follow me on social media, or have never asked to interview me. And I just think that it's like, oh, she doesn't matter, who cares, even though the Lakers franchise in itself is important, I do think there's still that barrier there. And, that just takes time to evolve and to change, because I think younger generations don't look at gender as something that, divides. It's, gender is not something how you look at a person. It's the person that you look at, not their gender. But, there's a lot of established people that it's uncomfortable, frankly, that a woman is in a position like mine. Thankfully, I would say in the NBA, in terms of the league and the other members of the board, I think we have a very progressive league, and we have great representation and, in terms of, board positions and NBA positions. So I think it's changed a lot since I got started in this over 30 years ago. Mm. But I think we do have a ways to go.
I think people forget too. You were part of many meetings many unreported meetings that all went toward either an acquisition or whether or not you hired somebody or whether you were part of the business long before you became the governor of the franchise. And I think people forget that. And I, even when you're, you're still as regular a person as I can imagine for the things you've done in life, it was almost like a humility that people couldn't really see because you were doing a lot of crap behind, you were doing a lot of shit behind the scenes. And I think, I just think it's good that you get credit for it now, that's knowing you as I do.
Thank you, Mike. We go way back. You've seen me in action. So, you know, I appreciate that you fill in the blanks for people who are just now hearing about me.
Well, I think it was just such an incredible turnaround when you missed the playoffs six straight seasons and you enter this season in which obviously getting Anthony Davis, having LeBron James, there's so much expectation. And yet the Clippers were, there were stories that the Clippers were going to make Los Angeles their town. And right up until the end, the Clippers looked so good. All of a sudden you guys went to a second gear and it was, I don't know, 10 years without a title in Los Angeles for the Lakers is probably 60 for any other franchise. Let's be honest. That's where the bar is. And so I guess congratulations on the championship, but has it sunk in yet?
It hasn't sunk in. You know, when you talk about the 17th banner, you know, it's like all of a sudden it's like, oh, wow, we got to make room for another banner. And we got to push those trophies behind me like a little bit closer so we can fit another one in there. So, it hasn't sunk in. But yet for me, you know, and you know, to talk about what's happened since my father passed away in 2013 and all the changes that have happened, to me, this seems we're back to where we were kind of like that. This feels normal to me. It's the last, you know, 7 or 8 years that things were topsy-turvy. And getting the team back into the conversation again. I mean, my goal was to see the team get back in the playoffs. The idea that we weren't in the playoffs last season and we went straight to being champions, you know, it kind of exceeded my expectations of what was possible. But when you have a player like LeBron James, you know, you know, you go all in because, you know, how many more years he's going to play. I think he could play a lot longer. Just watching him, he doesn't look like he's slowing down at all. So I hope he plays a lot longer. But, you know, you want to make the most of his abilities, and that's what we did. And I think, you know, and you know, I want to show my respect to the Clippers because they've been consistent. They've been in the playoffs every year, those 7 or 8 years that we were struggling. And, you know, we needed to get back to who we were. You know, they had been, like I said, consistent and successful, and we hadn't, and we needed to get back to where we needed to be.
It's like Ali is behind me, my favorite sports personality, person of all time. He needed Joe Frazier as his rival in time to be as great as he could. I know the Clippers and you haven't, you know, knocked heads in the play, but there's always been, since Chris Paul finally arrived on the scene, which he should be a Laker, but that's another story. It's like a two newspaper town. I always feel bad when the one newspaper goes out of business because, you know, the second one is not going to compete like it did and it's going to cut its own butt. And all of a sudden you have somebody raising their bar. And sure. And I look at Steve Ballmer, who you're, I'm sure, friends with collegially, at least. This is a guy who, I don't know, he stands for all the right things in life. He gave a grant. I don't even know this, but I did a story for the CBS DC station back here. He gave a grant that $25 million that empowered to school districts to hire male African-American teachers because kids are essentially taught by Caucasian women still in America. And it's like, all of a sudden they're learning, but part of the learning gap for these kids statistically is they don't see anybody who looks like them teaching them. Mm-hmm. And so he, you know, they wouldn't even interview for the grant because they wanted it to be about, but Steve Ballmer wouldn't. And I've met him a couple of times. He wouldn't interview because he wanted it to be about the grant and the kids that got, and the kids and the people that got the grant. You're in that same ilk. You stand for the right things.
And you know, I admire that's a very important issue that he's supporting, and we're trying to do things to make using our platform to make things better and to take on challenges, and so I admire him for that. Who I was really looking at kind of took the Lakers mystique, or kind of what Dr. Bass had built, was the Golden State Warriors, and having kind of building a culture of winning to the point where they could draw a free agent like Kevin Durant to their team. And that's how the Lakers used to be. And so now we're showing that our organization and our culture is about winning, and hopefully, because we went through this time period where we were trying to get Carmelo Anthony and LaMarcus Aldridge, and they met with us and they said thanks but no thanks, and that was something that wasn't very Laker-like. And so I think the Golden State Warriors have really set the bar, and even though they struggled this year with injuries, I expect them to come back full force. And they're the class of the league for sure.
Even I'd be remiss if I didn't thank you. There was, and I sent you a tweet about this, a direct message, that there were a bunch of Native Americans who were really, that I've dealt with for years on the Washington name issue, and they told me personally, like, you have to thank Jeannie Buss for speaking out about that, because if her and Spike Lee and AOC doesn't say anything, and it's only a Native American issue. And, like, there were surveys about how this affected kids' self-esteem and how they saw themselves, and not just Native American kids, but all our kids. Like, we still have costumes when you can go to a Halloween store and dress up as a race. We don't have that for any other race but them. And for you to say that, for you to put that out there, and, I mean, for God Bless America, like, the name was changed. I mean, that was huge.
It's what started for me, like, and because I loved playing fantasy football, I was a huge, I loved doing the draft and talking crap with the people I was in the league with, and it was just so much fun. But when the whole Donald Sterling issue came up, I don't know if you remember, but there was the Clippers were in the playoffs, and the team didn't know how to react. They didn't want to represent this person who clearly was showing them disrespect.
That's right. They almost didn't play.
Right. And so what they did was they turned their jerseys inside out. Okay. Because they didn't want to wear something they were ashamed of. And that, like, all of a sudden it clicked to me that if there were players on the Washington football team that felt that way, and every day they had to put on a jersey that they felt disrespected people, all of a sudden I was like, I can't play fantasy football anymore. Well, the first year I said, I just won't draft any players from the Washington team. That will be my.
You're like the referee, Mike Carey. Mike Carey wouldn't work Washington's games secretly behind the scenes. Yeah, for the last 8 years of his career. And he was one of the best officials. And he asked the league, I think it's disrespectful. I don't like standing on that headless, that Indian head in the middle of the field. And he wouldn't work. And people found out about this later. And I'm thinking, you guys missed out on one of the best officiating crews as a fan base.
I didn't even know that. But I just couldn't. And then the next year I thought, wait a minute, I'm punishing players on the Washington team by not choosing them on my fantasy team. And it's not their fault. They're not the ones, like, they they got drafted there, they get signed there, like it's not their fault, the name of the team. So then I thought, okay, I can't support the league when they allow this to happen. And so it wasn't like I could change anything. It was just like, personally, if there was one person in that found it offensive or hurt them, as in my position with the Lakers, I would never want any fan to feel insulted or demeaned in any single way. And so that's where I couldn't understand why the business was allowed. It was just, it like nobody spoke out about it. And, you know, I made, you know, my statement about it and how I felt about it. And I tried to talk to as many people as I could, but, you know, I'm glad that finally there was the realization that a change needed to be made. And I know it's different. I don't believe there's issues with the names of, you know, the Chiefs. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a sign of respect, but it was the identification of a person by their color,
racial
skin.
Slur. A lot of Native Americans just right. don't like the whole, you know, sort of being mascotted, sort of they feel like it unpeoples them almost, like and it's sort of at some point, I get it. It's their religious and spiritual practices. And I'm still waiting for a team called the Fighting Whiteys, which has not happened, will not, God bless. The thing was, I was going to ask you all these newsmaker questions to make this interview go national. You know, you and Phil Jackson, do you still talk? Will LeBron retire Laker? And unfortunately, what's going to come out of this now is the amount of time the Lakers governor spends on fantasy football. And I think it's disconcerting, and I think that's really sad.
Well, yeah. I just, it's like, I can't play fantasy basketball. So like, it was like a kind of my outlet.
Oh, you're right, because you're an owner.
Exactly.
That's crazy. I didn't even think about that.
It was the only thing that was safe for me to do. And you know, I give it to the league that like, it's so much fun. And I think you have to remember we had a 20-year period where we had no NFL team in Los Angeles.
Yes.
Like that was my way of like, you know, watching football because we didn't have an LA team to cheer for. And so, you know, Team United, that was my team name. That was my football experience. That's so awesome. I will get back into fantasy football now that changed.
I love it. I'm going to take my kids eventually to a game because they changed the name. I think it's great. The flip side, of course, but being devil's advocate, I remember this great, The Onion, you know, the satirical newspaper, they had this great piece on Bono once and U2, and it was all phony, but it was hilarious. And it's like, the members of U2 were getting upset at Bono for trying to save the world. And they're like, when is he going to make a fucking record again? And I thought to myself, if you're an owner, on one hand, especially with your social conscience, you love these messages. You love the Black Lives Matter. You love that players were so impacted by with the racial reckoning in this country that they almost refused to play, but had real qualms about going into this bubble, almost like not the real world. And while America's burning in outside of that bubble. And so this whole thing with the league and everything else, but is there also a party like, okay, LeBron, we know you're trying to save the world. The reason you are able to be so have such a platform and be an entertainment mogul now and all these other things is because you're a freaking basketball player. We need you to be a basketball player. Do you ever think, does that ever go in your mind, or you know he has a balance in his own head about what's right?
I mean, this coming from my view, I think when Magic Johnson announced he was HIV positive, that he changed the way people thought about HIV and what was going on in the world. And he saved lives and he moved the ball forward. And he didn't have to do that. He could have kept it quiet. He could have, you know, said, you know, I want to spend more time with my family and just disappeared. But instead, he embraced it and he used his platform as a beloved basketball player to, you know, literally change the world. And so from that day forward, it's, you know, the power of our basketball players, and them embracing, you know, that leadership role or not. There's some that don't want to do that, and it has to be a personal choice that we allow them to have that platform. And, you know, and I think in this, the coronavirus, this pandemic, I think Adam Silver should be nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, because the decision he made to shut down the league, I think, made people realize quickly, this is no joke. Like, we have to take this seriously. And he probably saved thousands of lives by making that decision, because
the country shut down after that.
Exactly. And so, you know, the leadership at our league has been consistent in terms of, you know, yes, we are an entertainment sports, you know, company, but that we have a platform and a way of reaching people in a way that others don't. And, you know, there is some kind of responsibility to use that for the betterment of the world.
I think LeBron is so heads and shoulders above it as well. He, in my mind, when he put on the hoodie with Dwayne Wade and the Heat and took that picture, that was almost, to me, it was like the renaissance of social conscience among athletes again. Like, obviously, they aren't the barriers that, you know, Jim Brown and Muhammad Ali and Kareem and Arthur Ashe and all these John Carlos and Tommy Smith faced weren't there because of the economic power of athletes, but still there was this real sort of I don't know if Michael Jordan said it or not, but Republicans Buy Sneakers Too was this whole idea of don't offend either side, and don't be convicted in your public life, just have convictions in your private life. And LeBron said, no, we believe this Trayvon Martin thing was awful enough as a team and as an organization. I thought, like, nobody, there was no Black Lives Matter at that moment. There was no Ferguson. There was no George Floyd. There was, we weren't looking at ourselves like we're looking at ourselves now. And I think LeBron, you know, I give him so much credit. I think on basketball wise, just how many more titles does he have to win to have his own statue outside Staples Center?
This was my dad's goal when he bought the team in 1979, was to give Los Angeles a team that could be part of the conversation in the NBA. He felt that there was such an East Coast bias that people only cared about the Knicks or the 76ers or the Celtics. So, you know, the idea, like, you know, in his lifetime, his dream was to surpass the Celtics in terms of titles. And unfortunately, it didn't happen in his lifetime. And, you know, LeBron is, you know, somebody, you know, I've only recently really got to know him as a person. And I admire him so, so much, because we had dinner about a year and a half ago, and he talked about, you know, he knew the Laker history since he'd been in the league, but he'd done a real deep dive into how this organization came to be and learned about my dad. And he said to me, you know, what your dad built is something really special. And the idea that he left you in charge of it is really such a compliment to you. And I hope you realize that. And I think that he's taken on that, you know, what the Lakers mean to Los Angeles and wanting to get us over the hump, which was to, you know, now we're tied with the Celtics in terms of titles, but maybe take us to, you know, to be greater. So I think there's a lot of inspiration that he has in terms of getting the Lakers franchise a franchise that he respects, you know, back to where they belong. And that's kind of what he said to me right after we won the championship. He hugged me and he said in my ear, yeah, that, you know, we've set out what we wanted to accomplish and we've done it. But, you know, I believe that there's more in there and, you know, we'll just have to wait and see how everything unfolds. I mean, every team, you know, wants to win a championship and it's very difficult to win a championship. I think this particular year was the most challenging ever in that we can imagine, you know, being isolated in a bubble and, you know, sticking through it really showed the resiliency of this team and the commitment that they made to each other to see the process through. And it showed, and I couldn't be more proud.
Dave Wall, who we both know and has a long career with the league, he made a great point when I said, well, this is going to be an asterisk season for many reasons too. And he goes, yeah, but an asterisk in a different way. He said, I think that whatever team wins this is going to have one of the signature accomplishments in the history of professional sports because the season was canceled. And you had to go into this really hermetically sealed bubble while nobody ever wanted for food or entertainment. They probably wanted their families and they probably wanted a regular life or not to actually just go on the internet and find out what's happening in the world. They wanted to be a part of this, the movement and everything that was going on, many of them. And so I kind of agree with him now. I think this was one of the greatest accomplishments in the history of team sport. And I'm not saying that if the Dodgers win it all, it won't be but they didn't have the season that the NBA had. And they certainly didn't restart. And they certainly didn't come back and go into a bubble for a long time. So hats off in ways I can't even imagine. I think your father would be incredibly proud of you and the franchise.
Thank you. I mean, like I said, it's that I know that's what was his driving force. And I feel like I still report to him that I'm doing exactly, you know, I'm operating the team exactly the way he would have. And that's what was kind of troubling, in the years prior, that it just didn't feel like the Lakers. And I didn't understand some of the decisions that were being made and, you know, finally had to make a change and, you know, get us back on track. He entrusted me with this team and I will run it the way he would run it.
When I revealed that I'd been abused sexually as a child in a Penn State article about Penn State many years ago, some of the things I've written to this day has split me off with my family on that side. And it's sad and it's awful, but in some ways it was for a good reason. I can't imagine the split that you went through with your brothers and everything else. I look at how everything's come out on the other side now. Someone asked me this on Twitter when I told him I was going to have a podcast on you. He said, I think his name was John Kelly. He said, could you ask Jeannie what her father would say to her now? Like, what would he say to you now if he could say something to you? And maybe he has, if you feel like you still report to him.
Well, I make the joke that, like, I feel like I still report to him. No wonder I haven't had a raise in 8 years. just kidding. No, I think he would be very proud. And, like I said, it's very hard to win a championship, but his feeling always was you have to be part of the conversation. You can't win a championship if you're not making the playoffs. And in the 32 years he ran the team, they only missed the playoffs twice. And, you know, here we went 6 years without being part of the conversation. So, it's like I didn't understand what was happening and the decisions. We had a great coach in Mike Brown and, very defensive minded coach. And then 18 months later, they made a change and hired another great coach, Mike D'Antoni, but a very offensive-minded coach who didn't match the roster that we had. And when you're changing coaches every 18 months, your roster can't adjust that quickly. And so the decisions, I couldn't see a path that was being created to get us to be competitive again. And then striking out with free agents because, I was literally in a meeting where, you know, one of the free agents asked our front office, okay, well, who am I going to be playing with? You know, who's going to be? And they were like, well, we don't know yet. Like, we haven't put the roster together. And it was like, you know, what free agent wants to come to a team that's like, we can't tell you how we're going to use you or, you know, how we're going to make you shine, how you're going to be the best version of yourself and how we're going to take you to a next level. And, that's what I didn't understand. And that's kind of what we're going, you know, that's what the culture that we've created now, that we're very open communication with our players. And there's a collaborative feeling in terms of, just hearing what people have to say. Everybody has a voice. And, we struggled with, after making the change and bringing Magic Johnson in, we had some leaks that we were experiencing. And now those have been shored up. Because when you have leaks in an organization, then you now have created an air of mistrust that people can't speak freely because whatever they say is going to be out on social media. And, then when people don't trust each other, then they keep things to themselves and maybe they do talk off the record. And so, you know, we had that kind of going on and I really couldn't figure out where it was coming from, but now we've made the right changes and put the people in place. And, you know, there's this just great feeling of camaraderie and, sharing this experience. And, I think that a lot of people commented that they could see that in the Lakers and the teamwork and the respect and the love and the trust that's between teammates. And, you know, that allows you to be greater than just the sum of your parts. That's like the secret sauce that, you know, gets people to work that much harder because they know somebody has their back. They're not going to be standing out there alone. And, that's what I'm really proud of. And that's something, go ahead.
Sorry. No, I cut you off.
It's like, I have to give a lot of credit. You know, I had some great influences in my life, certainly my father, but also, you know, a person like David Stern and a person like Phil Jackson. So these were really important mentors to me and so what you see, the way I do things, they have a lot of influence on who I've become as an executive in this league.
Phil, to me, I don't know if he said it once or not, but when you talk about the secret sauce and it was something like this, you know, creating the sublime choreography of teamwork and how that's so underrated now and how Red Holtzman taught it to him in New York and how he try to foster the same thing in Chicago and Los Angeles, wherever he went. And I feel like it's easy to say winning is a great deodorant. And these guys, we make them out to be bad guys when they lose and they're knuckleheads. And when they win, they're tales of character, heart, and redemption. But the Lakers like playing together. There's no question. You could see it. And I'm not saying every team that wins at all likes playing, but this felt like the Warriors a few years ago, even before Durant, because they, you know, it was sort of like it didn't matter who got the ball and what time. If you could put it in, and I mean, it's the Alex Caruso character, you know, like he's very talented on his own. He could probably score 20 a game for another franchise somewhere, but and yet he fits in, and all these guys fit in their own roles. I was thinking, saying it out loud, like Anthony Davis, that championship doesn't happen if he doesn't come aboard. And Michael Lee, my friend who now went back to the Washington Post, one of my favorite basketball writers and a good friend, he made a great point. He said he was the perfect complimentary all-star future Hall of Famer for LeBron because he let LeBron be LeBron. He wasn't going to get in his way. And his personality is such that he's okay being quieter. And, you know, and yet he's such a he's a lead by example player. I think that was such an important acquisition. And people can say what they want about getting his friend to play with him. And Rich Paul represents both of them. But let's be honest, that was an acquisition that, irrespective of their relationship as people, it made sense for all the right basketball reasons.
You know, for me, like probably the most difficult part of this job is to, you know, participate in player trades. And we had this young core that, you know, I was felt very protective of, you know, Brandon Ingram, Lonzo Ball, Josh Hart, that, you know, it was really difficult for me to sign off on that trade, but to get a player of Anthony Davis's talent, you have to give up great talent. You know, that's how trades work. And, you know, so one of the lessons that my dad was always trying to teach me was my dad was a great card player and, you know, was even on the, you know, World Series of poker. Like he was that great of a poker player. And he would try to get me to learn how to play poker, but I'm a horrible gambler. I'm a horrible bluffer. I can't do that. It's just not in me. I turn red. I'm not a good liar or bluffer or whatever. And so he'd get frustrated with me. And, you know, I really couldn't understand, like, why is this so important that he wants me to be a good poker player? So he finally explained to me, the reason I want you to understand how to play poker, be a good card player, is that what people don't understand to be a good poker player is that you have to wait for the cards. You have to have the cards in order to play a hand. And what people tend to do is they, like, you know, try to overcompensate or rush. And he said, you have to have stamina and you have to wait things out and until you have the right cards. And he said, and here's where I know you have patience and I know you have stamina, but what I don't know is, can you go, because once you get the cards, you have to go from 0 to 100 and you got to play those cards.
Go all in.
And you got to go all in. And so when that trade happened, you know, it also included the number 4 pick because we had the lottery pick. So it was, you know, 4 big pieces, assets, cards. You know, my dad would say chips, you know, that you had 4 great things in order to get one. And, you know, can you make that play? Do you have the guts to do it? Can you turn it on when you need to? And so I kind of felt, hearing his voice at that moment, like, this is the time. This is when you got to play the cards. Mm. And like I said, you had LeBron James, and you have to make the most of what's remaining of his playing time. And it was time. And we had the pieces, and we did it. And we accomplished what I feel was a good trade for both sides. And, you know, and now Anthony is a Laker, and I couldn't be more proud that he is a Laker.
Oh, it's unbelievable. I just heard your dog bark in the background. We will get to our dog relationship in a minute. But look, there's so many good things here said. Did you still call, did you always call your father Dr. Buss to people who interview you? What did you call him?
I called him Dad. I mean, Dr. Buss, it helps when I do interviews to let people know I'm talking about the business side of things. Mm-hmm. And when I tell a story and I'm saying my dad was, you know, teaching me this, that's this is who he wanted his daughter to be, and the strong lessons that he taught me that I could use in life, just in not just in running a basketball team, but just, you know, the things that were important to him to pass on to his children.
And I don't know, everybody always talks about your father, your mother, Joan. I don't know anything about her. Could you just, you don't have to give us the I don't want to, the Cliff Notes seems too trite, but you know, I feel like she deserves some credit here. I mean, she brought you into the world, darn it.
She, you know, she passed away in December.
Past December.
Yes.
And see, so I didn't even know that.
Yeah. Well, it's like, I mean, and I'm glad that you brought her up, because it's like going through, you know, this was a very painful time period for me. I lost my mother in mid-December. I lost David Stern right after the new year. And then we lost Kobe Bryant shortly afterwards. And it seemed such a heavy burden of, you know, how am I going to handle this and losing, you know, these important people in my life. And, you know, what I talked about was how Laker Nation was, you know, we came together, like and you know, in periods of mourning and grief, you have to have community. You have to have people that you can lean on, because otherwise you feel alone and isolated. And you know, when Kobe passed, you know, he was a source of strength for me. One of the last conversations we had was he called me because my mother had passed away, and he had heard she passed away, and he wanted to check in on me. This was a person who I loved dearly, and I thought I would have the rest of my life as in terms of a sounding board for the Lakers and just things that were going on. And he, you know, we asked the league, you know, the night before he passed away, LeBron broke one of his records, and Kobe called him to congratulate him on passing his record. And, you know, we just had there's great synergy of, you know, Rob Pelinka, as running our front office, was Kobe's best friend. And that we just had this like strong group of people connected. And so I asked the league, you know, can we please not play the next game? We need time. Like it's really taking a toll emotionally on our players, on our staff. And, you know, and we were scheduled to play the Clippers, and the Clippers graciously agreed, you know, to postpone the game, because we were in this state. And you know, you know, when we did finally come back and play, LeBron made a speech where he said to Laker Nation, like, you know, I'm strong, you know, lean on me, you know, I've got broad shoulders. And that's what we did. Laker Nation leaned on LeBron to lead us in this grieving process. And it kind of became this, you know, this part of the season of keeping Kobe close to our hearts. And, you know, it was something that happened organically. You know, some people said, well, how did the organization tell the team to, you know, when Anthony Davis made that game-winning shot and said, you know, Kobe's name when he made it. I mean, that's organic. That comes from your heart. That isn't a marketing thing. That's real. And that's humanity. And that's people caring for each other in the time of grief and sorrow. And that's what gets us through it. That's the only way you get through it, is through that community and leaning on each other when we're sad.
I'm not crying because I I mean, I love David Stern. I think he was a great commissioner. I was very sad, and I went to his memorial service very, and I didn't get, even though I knew Kobe more peripherally through the job than anything, even though we had some real private moments, I didn't know him like certainly you did and others. And I didn't cry until my son, 10, came up to me, and he just, it was like a week later, and we were watching this Kobe tribute, and he goes, "Dad, you know what's the saddest?" And he goes, "Kobe's daughters aren't going to get to see him grow older." And I like lost it. I lost it because, you know, it doesn't matter if you have a dog, a child, like those are your babies. And you realize that those things pain. I probably should know this, but where were you when you got the news and how devastating was it? And by the way, I'm crying for you because it's a lot of loss.
A
person that was a father figure to you, not just business wise, but personally, and this guy who sort of been part of your life in so many ways, and sort of like, he's not the player anymore. He's this fully developed human being that's got so much to offer.
And I mean, it like some days you just felt like, how am I going to get out of bed? And, you know, and basketball felt normal because, again, like the community and sharing that love and knowing that we will protect the Bryant family, that we love Vanessa and Kobe's daughters, and that, you know, the loss of Gianna is devastating on so many levels. You know, when there was a day after Kobe retired, we planned to have lunch, and Linda Rambis and I, you know, drove to Orange County to meet him, and he brought Gianna with him because he wanted Gianna to, you know, see strong women in business. But I think he also knew that I was feeling down and feeling lost. You know, I hadn't made the change with my brother. And I think he wanted to cheer me up, and he wanted to show me, like, you're inspiring my daughter, and my daughter's going to inspire you to be the best you can be. And that is the message that I know what Kobe meant to me, but I didn't know how generous he was with his time, with other athletes, from not just basketball, but every sport. Like when won the US Open, she talked about, you know, she, like, Kobe was her inspiration, and she wore a Kobe jersey in her post-game interviews. And she talked about, you know, meeting him, and she said, "Someday I want to be as great as you." And Kobe said, "No, you're going to be better."
Yeah. And Naomi Osaka.
Yeah, Naomi Osaka. Sorry.
I mean, what Thank a you. Special woman she is.
And right. And like, and that, you know, I had no idea that they had that connection until she talked about it. And just hearing, you know, football players with the Eagles and soccer players in Europe, and, you know, that how he touched people, I know that legacy will never go away. Like, we will protect the family, we will love his children, and we will, you know, protect what Kobe stood for. And, you know, that's how we get through this pain, because it's painful and it's sad.
There are so many people that is, "Oh, Kobe's complicated legacy." I don't know if it was that complicated in the end. I think it was very simple. Here was a guy who made an awful decision once and never made that decision again, and really strove to be a better dad, be a better husband, be a better player. And what got me, another thing that got me, I got emotional, was when, having written Shaquille O'Neal's second autobiography of three, by the way, I don't know any 50-year-old man who has three autobiographies. God bless you, Shaq. But, you know, I, that was during a time, 2000, when we were writing that, when he just was, He loved Kobe the player. He hated him as a person. And they didn't get past that till later. When I saw Kobe Bryant calling Sharif O'Neal, Shaquille's son, who had a heart condition, was unsure that he was ever going to play again and had to switch college, all these things that happened to him. When I saw Kobe checking in on him all days and Sharif sharing the text, here's this guy. Like, he really loved Shaquille O'Neal's son, a person who was really, even though they got past that, they became friends. They were really rivals in time on the same team for a while. And I don't know, man, it just all of that together. So Joan Buss, good woman. How old was she? How long did she live? And by the way, if you got a meeting, you can cut this off at any time, but I love talking to you about your life.
Oh, thank you. I'm free till 10:30. So I have another a little while.
Okay.
She's a great woman, stayed in the background. Just a lovely, sweet person who loved to play slot machines. She moved to Vegas.
She was a one-armed bandit.
Yeah, she loved it. So
or the machines were abandoned and took her money.
And she loved music, and she's just a sweet, sweet heart.
Was it hard to maintain that relationship when your parents did get divorced?
Yeah, I think, I'm a product of divorce, and I think especially that era of time, parents tried to shield children from the, what was going on. And I don't know if that, I don't think they advise that now. Now you explain to a child that what divorce is, why mommy and daddy aren't living together. But I was just kind of left in the dark about it. So it actually led me to when I graduated from high school, I ended up going to live with my dad so that I had time, with him. And that led to our relationship growing closer and him buying this big old movie star mansion, because he said, if you're going to live with me, I need a bigger house. So we ended up moving to this old, it was called the Pickfair Estate. It was Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks. And it was, during the 80s, and my dad was very well known in sports, but all of a sudden we became like kind of Hollywood people, and we were hosting all these kind of celebrity events. And even in the 1984 Olympics, Pickfair became one of the hospitality spots for athletes. And, it just kind of changed the whole dynamic. I became like, a tour guide of this old movie star mansion. But Mary Pickford kind of became a substitute grandmother, even though she had passed away. She was one of the founders of United Artists. And what United Artists were was Charlie Chaplin, Douglas Fairbanks, Mary Pickford, and a director by the name of I'm forgetting his name.
This is Hollywood royalty, by the way. This is all Hollywood royalty.
The point was she, this was like the 1920s, and she had a seat at the table. She was like
a powerful woman,
right? That her voice was heard, and she leveraged her talent to get a seat at the table so that she could be part of the business decisions. And so she's kind of a spirit animal for me, and I've always looked up to her.
That's what a story. I mean, just growing up around that. Did Phil Jackson contact you after the victory and congratulate you? I know you're still friends.
Yes, we've been texting. We've talked to each other a few times, FaceTime. He's in Montana. He is, ever since the lockdown, he went to Montana just because, he's at that age that's, where they, we have to be protective of him and his health. And Montana is much more spread out, easier to social distance there than in LA, but he still owns his home in LA. So I haven't physically seen him, since he left in the winter, but you know, we talk regularly, and you know, he did text the morning of that game, game six. He said, "Don't pack your bag," like, and that, like, some people they take that as like, "Oh, what are you? Was he saying your guys are going to lose?" No, it's like, don't get ahead of yourself. You got this game still has to get played. That's that's the Phil Jackson. So, you know, a lot of the wisdom that I learned from him, and you know, just being on that side of things. Obviously, I'd been on the business side of running a team. I'd been on the business side of operating an arena, but you know, now I got into the side of how a coach thinks and how a coach approaches a season. And, you know, Phil had, you know, very specific things of how he did things. And that's important that a coach, you know, have a process that they stick to. And maybe sometimes it doesn't always, you know, go with how the business wants to run or whatever. It's just, you know, a coach has to be a leader and stand for the things that they believe in, because they'll be tested many times by their team. And, you know, but he had a holistic view of how a team should operate, and that, you know, the number 12 guy on a team is as important as the number one guy. And if you can't find a way to make everybody happy and fulfilled in their role, then you can't be successful. So, you know, he really illuminated that side of how things go downstairs as opposed to upstairs. And that was a huge connection for me to make. And we were together, you know, over 15 years. And,
yeah, 17, you know, I think it was 17 years.
Yeah. And I mean, I, you know, when I think of, you know, kind of how our relationship ended, you know, that was, you know, my dad's wish was to have my brother Jimmy oversee basketball, and I would oversee the business side of the operation. And he had put that in place while he was still alive, and you know, we were trying to make it work. But you know, Jimmy, you know, made a decision. You know, he decided to let Mike Brown go early in that season, the 2012 season. And, you know, because there was high expectations, because we had Dwight Howard and Steve Nash, and that you know, that this was a team that could possibly compete for a championship. So, you know, they made that decision 8 games into the season. And my brother came to me and said, you know, do you think Phil would consider coming back? And I knew that
when was
like,
this was,
you know, like in the fall of 2012. And, you know, I said, Jimmy, like, if that's the case, you know, I can't be in the middle of you two. If you want Phil, this is your decision. You're in charge of basketball. You have to be comfortable with your decision. You have to talk to Phil. I mean, I'm sure he would be open to it, but I'm not going to run interference or be the connective tissue here. It has to be something that you want to do, and you have to have that communication with Phil. And so, you know, he and Mitch Kupchak went and met with Phil and talked to him, and they made a case to him that Phil was intrigued with, that he felt, you know, that it, you know, it could be possible for him to come back. Because Phil always felt, if you have Kobe Bryant on your team, you can always win. And you know, he you know, Phil said, you know, can I have 48 hours to give you a decision? And the reason Phil wanted 48 hours was because he wanted to get cleared by his doctors, because he wanted to make sure he would be able to complete a season, and he wanted to talk to his family. And you know, and I was hoping for the best. I would really wanted Phil to come back, but I also knew that it had to be Phil's decision. So I wasn't applying pressure there or to my brother. And so, you know, that Sunday evening, because, you know, it was like Phil basically took the weekend to make the decision. That Sunday evening, Phil cooked dinner for us because I'm not a cook. So he, when he was cooking dinner, he put on a Laker t-shirt. And I thought that was him showing me a sign that he was going to take the job. And he'd ask his agent, who was based in Chicago, to fly out to LA on Monday. So that was another sign to me that you know, it was going in the right direction. So that Sunday evening, we went to sleep, and the phone rang around midnight, or a little before midnight, woke us up, and it was Mitch Kupchak calling Phil to let him know that they had hired Mike D'Antoni as the coach, and that, you know.
So Phil was pissed.
It was, I mean, first of all, to get a call in the middle of the night is not fun ever. And, you know, it just seemed kind of like a backwards way to do things that, you know, he had asked for the time, they agreed to it, and then they pulled the rug out from under him. And that was, for me, devastating. But I also knew that in order to make things work with my brother, that Phil would have to, you know, take another job somewhere else. And so I encouraged him to take another job. And, you know, he spoke to a few teams, but then when the Knicks came calling, that was the job he really wanted. Like that resonated with him because of what the Knicks meant to him and being able to be full circle. But he also wanted to be clear with me what would happen to our relationship. And I insisted to him that I'm sure we'll make it work. We can make it work. People have long distance relationships and they don't suffer. You know, people in the military are separated from their families. You know, who are we to think we can't make it work? But I knew in my heart that was like the first thing that was going to start to tear the relationship apart. But in order for my brother and I to work together, that pressure of Phil couldn't be in the background. So I was happy for him that he took the Knicks job because it was the job Phil dreamed of. But it also, I knew, was going to undermine the relationship that we had. But that was really what was going to keep, you know, my brother and I to be able to work together. And, you know, I, you know, supported his decision in bringing Mike D'Antoni into the Lakers.
I just feel like there was some weird choice over the, you know, the Lakers, the Knicks. It all helped dissolve this. I got to think, you stay with someone for 17 years, you know, you're not roommates raising kids. You're in love with that person. And I feel like push me aside if this is inappropriate. I feel like you still love him, or you're still in love with him in some ways.
I love him. I love him. I can't live in Montana and do this job. And I didn't think, you know, I mean, the way it was left, my brother was going to run the basketball side. So I it wasn't going to be something that I was going to have to worry about. But as time proved itself, and, you know, I was part of the negotiating team when we agreed to this, you know, 20 plus year contract with our local broadcaster at the time, Time Warner Cable, but now Spectrum Sports, you know, and their question to us when we negotiated that deal in 2011 was, we know how the team has been operated the last 25 years. How are you going to operate it the next 25 years? Mm-hmm. And the commitment was, we're going to be Lakers basketball. This is what we do. And we'll continue to run the team the same way. And that was important to me to express to my brother that I've made this commitment to our partners that, you know, we're going to continue to run the Lakers the way Dad did for the last 25, 30 years. Mm-hmm. And so when we didn't make the playoffs And, you know, we were going through this transition time. I said to him, I need to know for the business side, how we're going to operate. Like, I need to know, when are we going to be back into the playoffs? Like, how are you going to get us there? And he came up with the 3-year timeline, which then would have stayed private with the family, but he declared it in the media. So then all of a sudden this like 3-year timeline became this ticking time bomb that people were like crossing off the days. And I had no reason to not believe that that's exactly what would happen, that, you know, yeah, we'd have this downtime, but we would be on the road to getting us back into the playoffs. And, you know, when it started to become clear that that wasn't going to happen and we were coming to the end, and I had told him, I said, if we can't get to the playoffs in that time frame, then I'm going to have to make a change. And he was like, absolutely, I understand why you'd have to make a change. And so we were coming to that timeline, and all of a sudden, you know, some of the contracts that they had signed that free agent period when the cap went up, and, you know, the Golden State Warriors were getting a player like Kevin Durant, we were signing players that weren't in that top tier all-star level. And, you know, it just didn't seem to be like there was a direction or path that was getting us to where we needed to be. And that's when I decided to make the change. And maybe some of the pushback that people had about, you know, who we hired as our general manager and Rob Pelinka was that we didn't go through what would be a traditional search. But if people will recall, the timeline was I made that decision right before the trade deadline, right as the going into the All-Star break in that February, because I was afraid they were going to make trades that we wouldn't be able to recover from. So I had to make the decision quickly. And if I'd asked permission to speak to other assistant general managers around the league, it would have tipped the hat of what we were doing. As this was all coming about,
that's
my brother...
My
brother was, on the other hand, mounting a legal campaign to remove me from the position that I was in. And, you know, that
you fought back like anybody would.
Right. And I needed, at that time, I needed Magic Johnson, who truly is the hero in this story, because he came in and stood by me and you know, show, you know, if anybody knows Magic, and what a Lakers Nation knows is Magic is all about Lakers winning. Like, he doesn't accept anything else. And so they knew if Magic came back to the organization and joined me in what we were doing, that they had faith that we were going to put things in the right direction. And that's exactly what happened. So that Magic was there to oversee basketball while I battled it off scene, you know, trying to get things cleared out. And as the courts proved, you know, the judge agreed that it was clear in the trust that my father wrote that I was to be the head of this organization. And that what they were trying to do was put the team into chaos, which would have been devastating for the franchise.
It's one of the last great things that your father did. And I think it says what he thought of you and everything else. And it's what a legacy. Oh, man, we got to do a quick lightning round and get you out of here. I just, the whole Phil thing, I had one of my most fun columns was after 2010, and you were sort of like, basically like, yeah, when is he going to pop the question? And, you know, I played it with it in the column, and Phil was great with it. And you could tell that there was this almost fun back and forth of a young couple. And I thought Ramona Shelbourne, my former colleague at ESPN, and a person that you've really connected with, because she's just written some really thoughtful articles. Camelot was over. She wrote Camelot was over, and I almost felt like that too. Like there was a real love there. But it was almost impossible for it to happen because of your lives, because of who you were. Do you regret not marrying Phil?
I like to say that my dad had, his children, but the Lakers were his baby, and he left me in charge of the baby. And that
you weren't going to leave that baby. You weren't going to abandon that child the way you were emotionally abandoned in your own life. Damn it.
I can say that because
that happened to me too.
So, it's like, that's fulfilling for me. Like, this is, I'm single now, but the fulfillment I get from this family atmosphere and the relationships that I've built with the people I work with the players, current players, former players, we have the family that we were born to, and we have the family we build ourselves, and this family is what feels good to me, and I'm very happy. I care about Phil, I love Phil, but this is where I need to be.
Would you be fulfilled if you found a life partner at this point, or is it something like, if it happens, it happens?
If it happens, it happens. It's like, I can't imagine,
And I'm certainly not doing a match.com for you. I think you could probably do that on your own. But I feel real affection for you as a person. And I think you're just a good, you're just a good soul beyond the fact that you happen to be wealthy. You happen to be Governor Lakers, but you're a good soul above everything. And I want you to be happy.
Thank you.
I know that's kind of cheesy, but damn it, I'm going to say it.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
All right, real quickly before I let you go. Is LeBron James going to get a statue if he wins another championship?
Absolutely.
One of these people asked me this, but I have to ask it. Why isn't George Mikan, 5 championships, why doesn't he have a statue? Do you not like his glasses?
No, that's something that, we don't have a statue of Wilt Chamberlain either. The statues all came about because when we were building Staples Center, Michael Jordan had just gotten his statue at the United Center. And really, my dad gave so much credit to Magic Johnson, the Lakers wouldn't be the Lakers without him, that it just seemed fitting that we have a statue of Magic at Staples Center, even though he didn't get to play there. Staples Center wouldn't exist without him. And so that's kind of what started it all. And then it's just kind of evolved. And, it's not something you can just change overnight, but we can expand and add. And, we wanted to make sure that we got a Jerry West statue and a Kareem statue and obviously a Shaq statue. And, there's no limit to statues. So that's always something that can be on the table, and absolutely, if he agreed to it, LeBron would be one of the most popular statues.
Until I die, I will advocate for a Smush Parker statue. I know you don't care, but I do. Bruce, can you get on the line here, please? Cause we have to let Jeannie go. Are you there?
Of course I'm here. I was hanging on every word from both of you. I took 4 pages of notes.
This is the greatest interview we've ever had. This is the greatest interview we've ever had. I'm still, I love that, by the way, Bruce, I love that Jeannie is, one of her goals in life is to beat the Celtics for all-time titles. She has real trophies in the background of her office. You, however, have little miniatures that you blew up that the league gave us as media guys. And I think as a lifelong Celtics fan, you should be ashamed of yourself right now.
I am in the famous picture, though, of Paul Pierce dumping Gatorade on Doc Rivers in 2008. I was standing by waiting for Mike Tirico to finish up doing radio so I could take him on the court to do interviews. And yes, so it's one of the moments I'll always remember. And I was so sorry that it came at the Lakers' expense.
And my phone died, Bruce. I have no problem telling you that. You had a couple great text questions that you sent me. Can you read those a couple of those to Jeannie very quickly? Just because I thought they were really they're really thoughtful, and it was the kind of thing that I asked her about LeBron and the statue. I think LeBron's going to retire Laker. I know you hope he does. I hope he does. Just seems right.
I was one of the questions I had, and again, you don't have to answer it if you don't want, because the podcast is basically over at this point. Is Magic consulted on any of the team's decisions at this time? That was one of the questions for Mike. You don't have to answer it if you don't want.
No. He doesn't have an official role. That's why he can talk, you know, do interviews and talk about other players on other teams, but he is not part of that day-to-day process. But where I give him credit is that he saw this path of getting LeBron and then building a team that would showcase LeBron and allow him to lead us to a championship. So when I say he created the path, he did. We would not have LeBron James if it wasn't for Magic Johnson. So while he's not part of the day-to-day thing, you know, decisions, there has to be a boundary there. Otherwise, he couldn't talk about other players, you know, but he is still somebody that I'm close to and that I love dearly.
That was dope.
Man, was that ever a full stop? I could have gone on another couple hours. She was so engaging. Thank you very much to Jeannie Buss for sharing some time with us. Thanks also to my producer, Bruce Bernstein, as well as our talented editor, Tom Phillip. This doesn't get done without both of them. Please listen to all of our Pure Hoops media shows. Full Court Press with John Fanta comes your way each Tuesday with the best college basketball guests anywhere. Catch and Shoot 2.0 with my friends Otto Strong and Aaron Berlin is here each Wednesday. Buckets, Boards, and Blocks with my better friend Monica McNutt and King McClure drop in every Thursday. Their most recent guest was Baylor head coach Scott Drew. And BJ Armstrong and Eric Newman are here every Friday with the Pure Hoops podcast. I'm back each Monday with the Mike Wise Show. Please listen, review us, and leave a 5-star rating.
All right, let's go. Time to stick the landing.
Finally, irrespective of whether you're from a blue state, a red state, or anywhere in between, COVID-19 is still tearing through this country. So please wash your hands and stay at least 6 feet away from others and wear that mask. Don't complain about it. Just do it. That includes you, you loser radiologist in the White House. And please treat everyone around you, even strangers, as friends and be considerate, like I just was to the radiologist in the White House. And don't forget to keep our medical professionals in your thoughts. They are the real heroes. Also, we need to continue working for social justice as we strive for a more just and inclusive society, the kind of society Jeannie Buss wants for all of us. So please do your part and don't forget to vote. Until next week, aloha, people.
The Mike Wise Show used to be called The Wise Ass Show, but it remains a presentation of Pure Hoops Media.